episode 5 of Reading the Game, the podcast where baseball fans discuss the baseball books they love. I'm host Steve Klein, and this episode we're discussing The Shift by Russell Carlton. The book, published in April 2018, has been described as being positioned at the crossroads of sabermetrics and cognitive science, and as altering the trajectory of both traditional and analytics-based baseball thinking. I'm really delighted to be able to welcome to the show this episode Henry Cook from Absolute Bunts. Hi, Henry.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And a big hello also to co-host Phil Stone. Hey, Phil.
Hello.
Now, on Sunday, I was able to have a chat with Russell about his process in writing the book and also how his background in clinical psychology impacted the way that he wrote the book. We're going to listen to that interview first of all, and then we're going to come back together and have a bit of a roundtable discussion about some of the things that we liked about the book. So that's the first thing you'll hear, and we'll be back after this interview. Hi, Russell. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
It's great to it's great of you to come on. I'm really excited about talking about the book.
Oh, and, thank you so much. Thanks for giving up your time. Oh, thanks for giving up your time to talk to a hack writer from about baseball.
Well, it's over a year since you had the book published now. I think about 15 months since it came out.
Yeah, since last April. Yeah.
When did you first have the idea that you might like to write a book? And is this the book that you always thought it might be?
When I sat down to do this incarnation of the book, I realized I had some drafts from about 10 years ago, and they were really bad. I mean, really, really super bad. And, you know, I'm thankful that I kind of took a decade off to sharpen my writing skills before I really tried this. I people ask, you know, how long did it take? And I'm like, well, it was about 6 or 7 months worth of grind time. But a lot of it was, you know, stuff I had written about at Baseball Prospectus before. And so a lot of it was, I kind of had some rough drafts to work with. And so that was at least helpful that I didn't have to start from square one. Otherwise, it would have taken me just a lot longer to really do it. But, you know, I would say that I had it in mind. I really said I'm going to commit to doing this, I would say, I don't know, 6 or 7 months in advance of when I finished the manuscript.
And you mentioned writing articles at BP. I mean, obviously, yeah. That's how most people who've read your stuff will have come to you in the first place. I mean, aside from the fact that you were writing, obviously, more, was the process slightly different than writing for BP or much the same?
A lot of it was the same. And you know, some of it was I was updating stuff that I had done a few years earlier. Some of it was that I would take an article that I had written here and then 6 months before that, and then another one a year before that, that were all sort of on the same topic that I had kind of come back to here and there. And I would take them and try and melt them into one chapter or one section of a chapter so that it would be, it would kind of flow into a fluent narrative. So, I mean, it was a similar process, but it ended up taking a different form, and you end up writing in a very different way when you realize it's going to be a book rather than a one-off article for on a weekly website.
And why is that? I mean, is it just that you're aware of its posterity is it writing for BP more of a disposable medium? I mean, what's the biggest thing that's different?
Part of it is that you're writing on a bigger canvas. I mean, for a BP article, I would write 2,000 words or so. That was kind of my target each week. And, you know, a chapter, book chapter is, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 words. And so you just have more space to fill. But also, you know, you're right. There's a certain amount of, at BP, I'm imagining that this person, I'm going to get 5 minutes of their time. Whereas in a book, you know, this is something that somebody is going to be willing to sit down and devote, you know, however many hours it would take to read it. And so you have in your head, I can go a little more leisurely. I don't have to jump right into into the conclusion and right into the numbers, I can kind of take a little more time to set it up and then linger a little bit more on what it all means.
And from that, in that sense, was it more, perhaps a bit more fun? I presume you enjoyed writing the book, or did it?
I did. I enjoyed the process of it. It was something that, you know, as I got into it, I was, I'm writing a book. Oh, I never thought I'd do this. But I did enjoy it. And it did kind of feel differently, partly because, you know, at BP, I was on a weekly publishing schedule. And so you always had that satisfaction of being done every week. And this, you had to, I would go back time after time and play around with words on something that I had already written. And I'd have to be, and that would be, sometimes you kind of had to stop yourself and say, you know, look, at some point you have to call this thing done, and you don't have that deadline right there looming over you that you have to hit publish. And so there was that aspect of it that I really had to kind of figure out for myself too.
And does it, you talk about it being done. I mean, presumably, cause it came out, was it March or April last year?
April 1st. Yeah, April 1st of last year.
And then, so you were done with it, for all intents and purposes, right, probably right at the beginning of 2018 as it getting ready to publication.
I had a September 30th deadline from the year before, so in 2017. And that's when they officially wanted the manuscript. I had finished off my first draft of the manuscript in April of 2017.
Right.
And I had, and I wanted a manuscript in hand before I shopped it to publisher. Some people will do a book proposal on spec, and with the idea that, okay, I'm going to propose the book, and then after that, I get the contract, I'm going to write it. I, for my own purposes, I wanted to have it ready to go. I wound up getting a deal fairly quickly. And then from there, I ended up doing some rewrites kind of over that summer. But as of September 30th, they wanted it in-house. And then we were doing edits, and the editor at the publisher had some things that went over, and they wanted some reductions just because it was too long. So it is a much longer process than just kind of writing the manuscript. There's other stuff that happens along with it.
And is it still in your head? I mean, it's coming up to 3 years, 2 years, two full years, isn't it? Since you finished writing it, is it something that you still think about? I mean, because I only ask because I've spoken to writers about stuff that they wrote maybe 7-8 years ago, and they have to refamiliarize themselves with it a little bit because they've moved on so much from it. I mean, is this something that, because as someone who was writing shorter form articles for such a long time, and then you wrote this book and now effectively stopped writing. I mean, it's at least for public audience. Is this still something that lives on in your head?
It does. And at one point I actually had, I popped open a Microsoft Word file and I had started, you know, chapter one of book two. And I have somewhere on my thumb drive somewhere, I've got, you know, most of chapter one of the next book written. But the thing was that, you know, life got a little more complicated just in my life, and my wife and I welcomed a couple of twins into the world, and so that took away some of my time. And then also getting hired by the Mets, I can't write publicly anymore, so I had to shelve that idea. I think that there's probably another book in there somewhere that I could write. But you know, on the other hand, as a writer, and I do this just kind of in my free time, I've been thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll try something different. Maybe I'll try a novel. Maybe I'll try something. Because now that I've proven to myself that I can write 100,000 words, I'm thinking, well, if I can't write about baseball, I mean, there are other things that I like in life. Maybe I'll try one of those.
Awesome. I mean, that'd be amazing to read. Amazing to read a novel, a Russell Carlton novel. I mean, for me, I read the book for the first time towards the end of last season, and and then I've reread it in the lead up to talking to you today. It wasn't really until I reread it that I recently that I realized how much it had influenced me. And I mean, I think part of the reason is that I was in the off season, I wasn't watching baseball very much, obviously. I was doing live baseball. Now seeing baseball, it kind of reminds me that
so much of what I'm looking at now is stuff that I've read about in your book. I mean, for example, expected value, obviously, sure, whilst not new, the way right. you presented it in the book kind of made me think about accountability and culpability when analyzing. I support the Giants, so they're having a pretty mm-hmm. down year.
Sure.
And trying to understand who to apportion blame to for their terrible
right,
season.
Right, yeah.
But also even little things like seeing runners held at third, that now really grates with me. And I realize that's because of your mm-hmm. because of your book. And even things like in terms of understanding the role of the manager and kind of creating an environment in the clubhouse, all those kinds of things. I mean, it's now 2 years, nearly 2 years, obviously over a year since mm-hmm. the publication of the book. Which chapter or which sort of part of the book do you look back on with the most fondness?
The one I actually, the chapter that it was always most near and dear to my heart, and actually when I went to the publisher and I said, here's an example chapter, was chapter 4, which was entitled The Perfect Team with hyphens. And I really like the idea of where can we see how baseball players fit together in ways that when we kind of pull them apart and look at them just as individuals, we don't really see the value that they create. Is there a way that, you know, one player feeds off of another? And in the book, I get into, you know, the way that, for example, if you put a ground ball pitcher in front of a set of four very good infielders, he's going to look better than if he was in front of four very bad infielders, because, you know, they're going to pick up his ground balls and throw the guy out, whereas the bad infielders are going to let a few more through. It's not that the pitcher's doing anything differently. It's just who he's playing with that makes the difference. And I think that that's one of those things that we don't, and I talk about this in the book, we don't really have a word that describes what that is, what that value added is. And I think that that's, when I look back, I think that's the place where I'm the most proud of what I wrote. And I, you know, if I have to have something that goes down as my epitaph, maybe it'll be chapter 4, The Perfect Team.
I mean, it's interesting you talk about language, because there's another reference to something that we don't really have in our lexicon, at least when discussing baseball, which is about giving away a tie, or, you know, or giving away, which is a really interesting thing. I mean, do you think that, and then as well, you talk about the story of Joe DiMaggio and comparing his feet with the feet of Ted Williams, you know, his on-base streak, and about how, as well, I suppose as well, the MVP discussion, obviously Mike Trout,
right, Miguel Cabrera,
Miguel Cabrera, you know, the Triple Crown. I mean, do you think the way we understand baseball is so much about language and that kind of history and narrative, the way that we value baseball players?
Oh, I have no doubt. I mean, I think that because, and speaking as a psychologist who, you know, I watch how people speak, and not only what they say, but what they don't say, and then sometimes how they say it that can communicate more than just the words themselves. I mean, I think that we are very much prisoners of the language that we are able to use to describe something, and baseball's no different in that sense. You know, I mean, in the book, I talk about, you know, the thought that we don't have a word for my team is not losing. We have a team which my team is winning, but that excludes a tie. And it turns out that a tie mathematically is just a very, very important part of the game. And, you know, teams don't seem to value it that way because we don't have this word that means, you know, a tie is something that's important and we need to really protect it in some way. And I think that not only has colored baseball strategy, but then even the way that we think about, you know, a game that you know, you go into the ninth inning tied and you end up losing. Well, you know, that one kind of got away, versus a game that you were winning in the ninth inning, but you give up the both the tying and then eventually winning runs, and then you lose that game too. But that one feels just so much different. And I think that that's when I was writing publicly, and even still now when I'm, you know, not writing publicly, I still try to look for those words that aren't there, that they're, I call them the unspoken words, that get into how can we name something that we might know is there somewhere intuitively, but we can't say it. And once we have that word, what does that then mean for us? And how can we alter our strategy accordingly?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, much of the book's praise, at least in from what I've seen of it, is that it kind of treads a middle path between, you know, seeing baseball as a numbers game, yeah, and, you know, sort of ripe for advanced statistical analysis, but also a game that's ultimately played by humans, not robots.
Right.
Yeah. And understanding its various intangibles and the extent to which those intangibles have an influence on the game. I mean, in that sense, it appeals to both, I'm stereotyping, but, you know, that kind of old school and new school fan. Was that a particular goal of yours, or was it just a happy accident?
It was a very, very intentional on my part. And I, you know, my training is as a psychologist. I have a degree in clinical psychology. I have worked with people in the therapy room. I will ask, okay, well, what is going on in this person's mind, and how can I reach out to them as a human being and to see that, to help them change how they're working through whatever they're working through. But, you know, you look at it, you can extend that. Well, baseball teams are just 25 guys. And it's interesting when you sit down and you're like, oh, you know, just these are just a bunch of 27-year-old guys kind of sitting around in the clubhouse playing cards or talking or whatever. It's just that they're all happen to be wearing the same matching pajamas. And they, you know, they go out and they play this game. Well, you know, how do they operate in, you know, a game is basically a set of weird rules that you have to try and beat. You know, that's basically a psychology experiment right there. You give somebody some weird rules and see how they react. So, I mean, I wanted to approach it from a very psychological point of view. When I pitched it to the publisher, I even said, I don't know if this is even a baseball book as much as it's a psychology book wearing a baseball hat. And when I went to write, and when I was conceptualizing what it was going to be, I very much wanted it to be a very human book, and to try and to walk that line. And I'm, you know, I'm happy to hear that people have not only recognized that, but seen that as a strength of the book.
Oh, absolutely. It makes it unique, really, in books of the genre, I think. I mean, it really makes it accessible and really resonates really strongly. I think given your background in clinical psychology, it's really interesting to read that, you know, those sort of autobiographical snippets that sit alongside the baseball analysis. I mean, for me, that was some of my favorite parts of the book, partly, I think, because it allows the reader to connect to you in a way that writers don't often allow themselves to be connected with. Right. I mean, you mentioned your father, you know, you're going to games, the development effectively of the relationship you have with your wife, and taking your children to games. I mean, there's a real warmth in there, which is really nice. But was it always your intention to incorporate that self-disclosure in the book? Like, does that come from your clinical psychology background? And like, was there anything that you thought twice about including? Or, I mean, you probably won't tell us what you didn't include, but was there anything that you were hesitant to include?
I did mean for the self-disclosure piece and I put a lot of, I think each chapter opens up with, and occasionally in the middle of the chapter, I'll break into a story from my life in some way that I at least thought related to what was going on. Some of them I connected better than others. It is something that self-disclosure is something that I used in the therapy room. I used when I taught. It is something that I had a conversation with myself of, when I was planning out, this is how I'm going to write my chapters, is this something that I want to do? Because this isn't something that happens a lot in sports writing. It's something that you know, you just, let's go in, let's talk about the games, and let's do that. You know, I wanted, in the same way that I wanted the book to be about the humanity of these players and how you can see that through the numbers, I felt like I couldn't really do that if I wasn't willing to open myself up as a human and to say, you know, look, are these, and you know, most of them are just silly, funny stories about my life, but I wanted somebody to be able to say, you know, this is just a fellow traveler, and this is who who he is, and this is where he's coming from. So that was my goal, and there are a couple of things in there that I thought twice about. If people want to read that, I'm sure they could probably pick out what those were. I will simply leave it at that. And you know, there was some stuff that was left on the cutting room floor, not more for space than out of, you know, any personal sense of embarrassment or anything like that. It was just, there wasn't room to include everything. So, you know, when I think I mentioned the, you know, chapter one of book two, I actually pulled something from the cutting room floor and put that in there. And I said, oh, this is the one I couldn't squeeze in last time. So maybe I'll use it here.
Yeah, I'll look forward to it. I mean, one of my favorites is this, because I think it will have resonated with a lot of readers, that time when you're first living away from home and you're attempting to do some laundry.
Yes.
It leads you into kind of describing or trying to understand players in terms of maturing people and how organizations, how teams could provide them with support. In terms of basic things, you know, nutrition, making sure they're getting enough sleep, making sure they're being looked after, making sure they have access to, you know, proper mental health support. And, you know, is that something that you see, is that kind of human element? I mean, we're talking about Ben Lindbergh and Travis Sawchick's book Off Air a little bit.
Yes. You know? Mm-hmm.
Do you think in a sort of Moneyball sense, if teams are looking to carve out a competitive advantage, is this an area where there's a big market inefficiency in 2019?
Yeah, I mean, in the book I go into, in that chapter where I've, you know, have the problems with trying to do my laundry, I talk about some work that I did, some research I did about 5 years ago, where I was calling around to different department or different teams and asking, you know, what kind of supports are in place for these players. And, you know, it was interesting because there were some teams that were, they all had an idea that this was something that was important, and that it's something that that they needed to at least think about. And I think all of them had something that they could call a plan. But you know, it was also something that some teams were clearly further developed than others. And, you know, in the book I talk about, you know, these, especially with minor leaguers, you're talking about, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, living maybe in a different country for the first time, certainly probably away from home for the first time. And, you know, some people can just, they're okay with that. And some people, they need a little more support. And if one of those guys can become, you know, by giving a little extra support, he's more focused on what he's got to learn about, whether he's a pitcher or hitter, whatever he's got to do to make it to the big leagues. If you can get one extra guy up to the big leagues based on that kind of support, you're probably going to cover whatever costs you incur from that sort of support. So it was some interesting work that I enjoyed doing it when I was calling around and just kind of seeing what people were doing. And yeah, I think that, you know, I think a lot of teams at this point are looking deeper into that human element, if only for the fact that, you know, it's actually pretty low cost stuff to do compared to the other inputs that we put into a baseball team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting thing for me, you talk about in your writing, writing the book, you kind of, you tell the reader that you're approaching the game through a lens of dispassion, and that that's sort of attempt to provide some sort of objectivity in your analysis, your research. But you're, I mean, if I get this right, you're a childhood Indians fan.
Yes.
Who's developed, as you've got older, and to an extent, a rooting interest in the Cubs.
Yeah, I lived in Chicago for six years, right?
Yeah, you now live in Atlanta, go to Atlanta games with your family, and you're employed by the New York Mets. I mean, how dispassionate about baseball are you? And is it a difficult thing to do?
A number of years ago, when I was living in Cleveland, and I did some work for the Cleveland Indians as well. And I say that working for the Indians made me give up being an Indians fan. And that sounds horrible. because they, you know, it's like, what did they do to you? Well, no, they were fine. They were wonderful. I enjoyed my time there. But what you have to do is that when you work on the inside is you can't think like a fan. And, you know, fans kind of have a shorter window for when they're hoping that, you know, if a team is on a rebuild, when that will be done. And sometimes, you know, you have to say, you know, look, it is in our best interest if we take a little bit longer view. And that's, you know, that can be tough. And so I found myself saying, you know, it's less about that experience of fandom, and it becomes something very different. It becomes part of, you know, a project that you are a member of, and within the context of a team of people, not a team of baseball players, but a team in the front office that's putting things together. So, you know, I can honestly say, you know, I have friends back in Cleveland, and I have friends back in Chicago, and friends here in Atlanta who are all fans of those particular teams. And, you know, I am a member of the Mets now, and I am very happy to work for them. And you know, if it's not going to be the Mets, I know that this year, then if one of those others team wins, I know that there will be a lot of other people whom I care about who will be very happy about that. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Well, you're hedging. You've got four teams you can root for if on any.
I need to move a few other places, and then no matter what happens, I'm good. But, I don't know. My wife and I have a pledge to each other that we're never, ever moving ever again. So I'm here in Atlanta for the long haul. So okay.
you just have to be headhunted by some other organization.
I guess so.
Okay. Well, I'll finish off with a question from on Twitter, because I trailed this conversation with to people and sort of got some feedback. And one question we had back was from a guy called Daryl Pruitt. I'm hoping I'm getting his name right. He's at Daryl Pruitt 95 on Twitter. What kind of response, to your perspective, have you received from A, the analytics community, and B, MLB teams? And he says there, other than the Mets, because obviously they hired you.
Right. Well, the Mets apparently liked me well enough.
Yeah, the Mets are on board.
Yeah, that's cool. It's been very positive in the sense that there is a respect for well-done, good scientific work, no matter what perspective it comes from. You know, I have worked with it in the writing community. There have been people who have majored in physics and economics and English literature. You know, you kind of get you kind of run the gamut of that. And I find that if somebody is, even in things that I don't fully understand, because that's just not my skill set, I find that if somebody is approaching the game from a really honest scientific point of view and is using good research methodology, there's room for that. And I've never felt like, you know, a weirdo because I'm a psychologist. It's just kind of, oh, okay, well, what can you tell us about how psychology, or what psychology tells us about the game of baseball? And that has been that's been really nice. And I encourage people that if they are considering getting into baseball writing and especially in the analytics area, people will say, well, what should I write about? And well, you know, think about what you do, where, you know, what you have studied, what your strong points are, and start from there. And if it is good, well done work, there's going to be a good reception for it in the analytic community. And that's, I think, something that I see as a point of pride for the way that the analytic community has developed over the last 20, 30 years. I'm happy that I got to be a small part of that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I think we'll just, in terms of time constraints, we'll wrap up there, but I mean,
sure.
I'd like to say thanks very much for coming on. I'm really looking forward to reading, Book Two, Chapter One, when it finally hits the show. Are you going to be using a pseudonym for your fiction work?
No, I would just I don't like pseudonyms. This from the man who wrote for a couple of years as Pizza Cutter.
I was going to say, it's a hell of a pseudonym. You can't really top that.
At the time I was still working in therapy, and they told us that if you're going to write online, use a pseudonym just so that your patients don't try to find you. But I don't see patients anymore, so I can just write it under my own name. So, I mean, it's a, I have no idea. And it also depends on whether I actually ever have the time between the kids and everything else I got to do in life. But so at some point,
18
you know,
years, we'll look out for that.
Yeah. Call me back in 18 years.
All right. Listen, thanks Russell. Thanks very much for coming on. It's great of you to give up your time, and I'm a massive fan of the book. So really honored to have a chance to chat about it with you. Thanks very
much. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, well, that was excellent. It was lovely to be able to talk to Russell, and I was very grateful for him for giving up his time and for talking about the book. He had a real enthusiasm, which I hope came through in the interview. Coming back to you guys, so we start with you, Henry. When did you first come to the book? What were your first impressions of the book?
Well, I first came across it for very, very silly reasons. I think it popped up in my Amazon, you know, if you've read this, you may also enjoy this. And John and I, who I do the podcast with, had been talking about shifting, the literal shift in baseball when, you know, players reposition themselves to compensate for the handedness of a batter. And I, holding my hand up here, I genuinely thought the entire book was about that. And the reason I wanted to buy a book entirely about that entire phenomenon is because it is quite controversial in America. And I find that quite strange that quite a basic tactic, seemingly from my point of view, would be so controversial. So I wanted to understand its place as a kind of cultural entity, and an entire book about that, you know, why not give it a go? And when it arrived, actually, it turned out it was far richer than that. And I didn't want to try and pretend it's because I've been doing my research. And my first thoughts are that it was a book that I didn't know I needed in my life, but I'm very glad that I do. It's a really good, not response as such to Moneyball, but it's, I recommend reading this one after that. And it just has, it's a lot of a richer experience. I think it's a far more accurate representation of why stats are important in baseball, and the actual stats, the relationship between stats and scouts. Whereas I think Moneyball makes a very sort of binary assessment of those. To read Moneyball is to think that on-base percentage is the only stat that matters, and that the players themselves don't matter so much. And I think this gives even fledgling baseball fans a far better understanding of the elements that are involved in managing a team.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about the shift, because you're not the first person, I think, who's commented on that they thought it was going to be about infield shifting. I don't think it was Russell's working title. I'm not sure if that was something that the publishers put in. Probably a really good thing to have asked him when I spoke to him. It was a bit annoying that I didn't. Phil, how about you? When did you come to the book? What were your first impressions?
I think we must have talked about it maybe a year ago. I think it was something that you'd flagged to me. Ignored it. That sounds rude, but I didn't really think too much about it. And then all of a sudden it was mentioned on this UK-based baseball podcast. And it was only then that I was like, oh, it's not a book about the defensive shift, which, again, I was totally guilty of that as well.
Oh, it's not just me.
So it wasn't just you. And having looked at some of the reviews on Goodreads online, it's not just us either. There's other people who are guilty of making that judgment based on the title alone. It was only really a couple of months ago that I think even before Steve and I talked about including the book on the podcast, that I grabbed hold of a copy and read it.
Yeah, I mean, I was similar in the sense that I found out about it. I think I must have found out about it from listening to Effectively Wild when it came out. It was sort of trailed quite a lot, and I remember an episode with Russell appearing on Effectively Wild. But I didn't read it straight away. I bought it, and then I don't think I read it till the off season. And then it wasn't really till rereading it this last sort of month or so, maybe 6 weeks, that it made me realize how much it's influenced me, or how much of an impact it's had on me in the way that I watch baseball. Have either of you felt that?
I mean, personally speaking, I don't know if it's changed the way I'm watching the game, but it's definitely been a source of reassurance that some of the things that I suspected might be important are. So the example I'd use is that, this is a really kind of basic example, but I get great satisfaction in watching a very long at-bat that ends in a walk. But it isn't just because then the game goes on for longer, because it's plenty long already, but because I suspected you're obviously wearing the pitcher's arm down and he has to get swapped out by someone else far sooner than anticipated. So as much as it's not the most aesthetically dramatic or pleasing outcome that you can have from an at-bat, I was thinking like good discipline by that, you know, by the hitter. And when I was at the London series, funny enough, I was sat next to an American lady who traveled over for the game, and I sort of fist pumped when there was a walk as kind of half a joke. And she's like, why are you celebrating? That's so dull. And it really made me realize that it's okay to sort of appreciate those kind of things. And the other one that was a source of reassurance is, and this is one of the chapters towards the end of the book, is, I know this is going to sound silly to say out loud, that baseball players are human. They're not, I forget the phrase, you know, they're not just random number generators and or some kind of fairy tale where everything's worked out for them. It's very much in between. And the things that he points to are, you know, they're away from their families, they eat a lot of junk food, and maybe they get no sleep. And that might contribute 0.15 of a run over the course of a season. But over the course of you combine a number of people all with those issues, and that can add up to the difference between a win and a loss. And yeah, it was just reassuring to think about all those tiny little shards that influence a season. And I'd wondered about that. And it was nice to see there's someone else thinking about it in those kind of details.
Yeah, I think that for me, it's just his depth of analysis. That was really engrossing, definitely. I don't want to cut you off, Phil. I just realized I didn't let you answer the question about the way that you watch the game. Do you feel like it's changed the way you've watched the game at all?
I wouldn't say it's changed it. It's maybe reinforced is probably the word I would use, in that there's certain stuff that he talks about that I've either read about, maybe even in Baseball Prospectus, but certainly through like listening to Effectively Wild, that some of the themes that has been discussed on other podcasts appear in the book. And I think in the interview that you had with him, he mentioned that the articles that he'd written were used as like a jumping off point for for chapters in the book. So it's more like it reinforced my baseball watching experience. And in particular, like the thing I'm fascinated by is run expectancy when runners are on second with one out versus nobody on any basis with two outs, and the kind of minutiae of that and how important it is to have a runner on first, but how it might be a disaster if that runner attempts to steal second and fails. That the kind of minutiae of that and the kind of the game theory and the gamesmanship and the impact, the small impact it will have on the outcome of the game, but like Henry just said, the little things all add up to make possibly a significant difference come the end of the season.
I mean, yeah. I don't know about, sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to ask if this applied to either of you two, which is, it wasn't so much that influenced the way that I watched the game, but it's actually got some really decent general advice just to take on board outside of baseball. I don't know if this sounds really silly, but the focus on the tendency of human beings to remember when things didn't work rather than they did. So someone attempts to steal a base and then they fail. And it's like, oh, well, he always does that.
Yeah.
And conversely, I was watching the Rays play the Yankees the other day, and Aaron Hicks came on for the Yankees as a pinch hitter and got a home run. And I knew, my brain immediately went, well, next time I see him, I'm going to go, that guy always gets home runs. Now, I don't know his stats, but it serves as a really good sort of cognitive device that next time I see Aaron Hicks, I'm going to say, no, hang on, this could go completely differently this time. And last but not least, I'm thinking about getting this phrase tattooed on my back. I've written it down. And it's there's got his mantra about making decisions based on the best possible outcome. Obviously, he's talking about base running, and the fact that, you know, the third base coach should just be removed by, was it like an arrow on a stick?
Yeah.
But you can apply that to real life. He says, when faced with competing strategies, pick the one with the highest expected value. And as ridiculous as this sounds, if I'm sat at home and I've got the choice between going to the gym and ordering a takeaway, I know which one I'm going to feel better about in the long run. And I've got Russell's words, you know, in my head now, and it has been a really positive influence just beyond baseball as well. I didn't know whether that applied to either of you two or if that just sounded ridiculous.
No, it absolutely does. I mean, mine's I don't talk about baseball books that much outside of podcasts and meeting up with people who like baseball. It's not like there's very, very often very little to take away from a baseball book that would apply to somebody or be able to converse with about with somebody who doesn't like baseball. But in this book, there were loads. Some of the thought experiments and the hypotheticals completely transcended baseball. It just applied to general life. That was really interesting. I remember going into work and talking to the one about the train, or they call it the trolley, but the, you know, when there's a train coming down the tracks and decide whether to divert the tracks. I mean, that's just a really good sort of question to discuss with people, you know, sort of philosophical question. What do you do? So that definitely, I'm not sure about, I don't know about how much this had an impact on my personal thought processes, but no, certainly in baseball, I mentioned it in the interview. I mean, it's about understanding who's responsible and who's to blame for things necessarily, or who's accountable, who to give credit to. When you're talking about win expectancy, that's been a big thing for me. And yeah, the stop sign, you know, when the third base coach is saying stop, that's just now. It just makes me cringe when I see runners third on a sacrifice or you know on a hit into the outfield. I just think, oh God, you know, just read the book. And yeah, it's frustrating. But yeah,
frustrating, but it's a really tough sell, I think, to sell that idea to a normal baseball fan. Like Henry was talking about the woman that he sat next to, going like, "Why are you applauding a walk?" You know, it's those things that if you were to replace a third base coach with a piece of wood and a sign with an arrow, and then the runner rounded and didn't get home, it's very difficult to go, well, statistically over the course of a season, that would be more successful. What I thought was fascinating about the book was kind of that marriage between...
Was that Bob Gibson?
I'm trying to not let him seep into this podcast as well.
It's osmosis. It's unbelievable.
I know, right? But yeah, I thought it was interesting looking at some of the ideas in the book. I think would be might be a tough sell to a general baseballer, like doing the icky things.
That's like Henry, you were saying about Moneyball. You know how Moneyball, very much of its time, sort of 15 years ago or so, it was like OB on base percentage, and it was like, wow, mind's being blown. You know, up and down the country amongst fans, sort of saying, "This is what's this new thing? What's this walk that you've been talking about?" You know, that at the time was so significant, almost like the pinnacle of analysis, or at least it was within the narrative, it was sort of sold as such.
Yeah.
Whereas now the sort of the spectrum of analytics is so much broader, and that people are so much more aware of how to gain even the smallest advantage from things, that somebody can be sitting at home saying, "Oh, why aren't you running from third?" You know, that's if anything else, just a marker of how far things have come with the analytical movement, I think, which is quite interesting, sort of sums it up to an extent.
I mean, what I really liked is that he's still very respectful of people that do want to go largely on anecdotal information. And you know, there's consistent references to the importance of language and storytelling in baseball. And he uses that powerful example of the Triple Crown against WAR. But he's not dismissive of the way that things are. He's positioning a new way of looking at things and why it could work. But he's never sort of rude about it, for want of a much better term. And I think that runs through. I don't know how he actually feels about it. Maybe he's far more, you know, I struggle with RBI. The first time someone explained how that worked to me, I was like, that is incredibly problematic, because a lot of the guys have done the hard work before you got on base and did the hit. But I do, what it helped me appreciate, his tone that he adopts throughout it and his acknowledgement of, you know, 100 plus years worth of specific baseball language, is that as much as baseball, the laws of baseball and the way that people talk about it is English, it is in its own way a foreign language to me. And I don't get to say, "Oh, so you didn't appreciate that walk, then you're doing it wrong and I'm a new fan." And so his objectivity throughout the book, I thought, was a really, unlike Moneyball, which sort of encourages you to go on the side of the statisticians, this is a far more kind of even-handed effort.
And I think that's possibly because of his background in clinical psychology. You know, that I think he makes reference to the fact that I'm probably going to bungle the exact thing, but it's on basically paraphrasing, sort of said he's like holding your hand and walking you through his analysis, rather than, you know, there's no real attempt to shove anything down your throat. It's very much this is a way of thinking about it based on. And this is, you can understand why these people over here would think about it like this. And I'm sort of talking quite specifically now about the MVP thing with Cabrera and Trout. But this is one perspective, and this is completely rational given this set of, with this way of thinking. This is the other perspective, and this is also completely rational given this is the way that people have been thinking for a long time about it. And there's no real point in having a massive argument about it, because you're just going to have two different ways of thinking about it.
Mm.
It kind of brings you onto the question, you know, which I want to ask about, how one of the things it's been credited with in lots of the praise that I've read, lots of the reviews I've read, have sort of talked about how Russell, in fact, he talked about it, didn't he, in an interview, about wanting to give the book appeal to both a more and less analytically minded reader. To what extent do you think he's achieved that, Henry?
I think he's done a great job of it. I mean, you're admittedly talking to someone who hasn't read a wealth of baseball books. I haven't really got many points of comparison, but to use a reference from my own job, so I'm an intelligence analyst by day, and then I fight crime by night. But broadly speaking, the things that we produce to sort of summarize threats for our customers, so that'll be managers or law enforcement, fall into two categories. And that is the kind of tactical, which would the equivalent in this book is the sort of tables of stats. But then there's the strategic, which is the kind of executive summaries of what the issue is. And he does both brilliantly, and that's quite hard to do sometimes, because if you're a statistician, I've seen some people who are experts really want to communicate all the minutiae to people because they're so proud of what they've done, and they lose the audience because they're being so specific, or they simply can't, they're so bright even, that they can't comprehend that someone doesn't know what an eigenvector is, which I don't know what that is. But what Russell does so brilliantly is that, yes, he hits you with some of the specific stats, and I'll hold my hand up and admit that sometimes they did lose me. I see the word integer and ratio in the same sentence and I'm gone. However, you always knew a kind of customer-friendly summary was always waiting for you at the end of it. And it meant that I didn't get too hung up. I did originally, I mean, we talked about this when I met you at that sort of softball event, that I was kind of struggling. So I felt as if I couldn't recall every single detail from it. But then I just sort of let that go. And I, at the end of every chapter, you got the gist of what he was trying to say.
Mm.
And that's a gift unto itself, really.
What do you think, Phil? That was a very pensive.
No, I completely agree. Like, I couldn't have summed it up any better, to be honest with you. Like, there were times that I did struggle with it, and I had to reread paragraphs or even chapters before I kind of felt like, okay, well, now I understand it, and then move on. But I think towards the second half of the book, I kind of changed tact, and I think also the second half of the book is slightly different to the first half. The first few chapters, or the first five or six chapters, are quite in depth, and maybe in the second half there are kind of more snippets of observations that Russell has made. And the second half of the book, I tended to read a bit more of like, well, I'm just going to go with it, and I'm just going to kind of let it. I'm just going to read it quite casually and let the words flow. And I kind of enjoyed that more, because, like Henry said, there was always the final paragraph was always like summarizing what you've learned. So I think kind of once I got over myself, I was able to enjoy it a bit more.
Did you have a favorite? Did you have a favorite chapter?
And it's not just because I'm a Red Sox fan, but it was the should Ortiz have bunted against the shift. That I found that, I think it was like chapter five, I want to say.
I think
it was fascinating. It was fascinating, like looking at
it was chapter five, sorry.
Yeah, I thought it was. Looking at a power hitter doing something that seems so counterintuitive, but also getting into the psychology of it. And it's like kind of Nick Kyrgios's underarm serve to Nadal in the recent tennis match. It's kind of something that it's acceptable, but it's not pretty. And it's the ugly thing. It's the icky thing. But actually just, you know, getting over yourself and ignoring the fact it's icky, it might be the statistically favorable thing to do, and therefore it should be embraced. I thought was fascinating.
But that goes, that you mentioned a game theory as well a bit earlier, because it's kind of happening a little bit this season, which is why it's interesting as well with Joey Gallo and stuff. You know, it's like if you get too good at it, if you get too good at bunting, then they're going to have to stop shifting, and then shifting, you know. So it's kind of like if you it's almost like poker as well, isn't it? If you declare that you're going to be bunting all the time, then all of a sudden then it's you lose that power. So you almost want to have this kind of toing and froing. It was a really interesting chapter, I thought. I also thought it was really sweet that it was basically because his daughter was like, why isn't he what's going on, why doesn't he just hit it over there? I mean, for me, that's one of the ways that he manages to make it accessible to so many people, is that he seems to give himself quite a lot of the book. That was just a little example there, you know, these little autobiographical anecdotes, which he describes a little bit like his self-disclosure. Do you think it works? Like, do you think that was the way that he uses, the way that he connects with the reader? What do you think, Henry?
I thought the anecdotes are an essential part of it. I kind of treated them like a much needed sort of pause between the kind of stats heavy stuff, especially for someone like me, that I can feel the kind of gears grinding together when I'm trying to read some of the stuff. And that's not on the fault of the writer, because he's really holding your hand through it. And I still, oh, there's the dog. Excuse me one second, I've got to go and shut the door now.
Okay. That wasn't the full key in the door experience, no?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I think my girlfriend's just come home, but I'm really glad that Watson managed to make a kind of cameo. It's only consistent with the Absolute Bunts brand. But I'm sorry, he cut me off, probably saying something awful. But the anecdotes gave me respite from the numbers, effectively. So I really enjoyed when they came up and just could sort of take a breath. But also, his anecdotes aren't just whimsy. They're always relevant.
Oh, yeah.
They always help you understand the point that he's just made, or lead you into one. And there's one I really wanted to sort of focus on, if that's okay with you guys, because it was a kind of semi-epiphany. And when you hear the one that it is, you're probably going to be massively underwhelmed. But I don't know if it's so much an anecdote, but it's the analogy he makes to breaking computer games, sort of playing them over and over again, setting yourself new rules as a one-player game. And it was a real eye-opener to me, because it was something that I've done, it was something all my friends did, but we'd never really talked about it, not because we were ashamed. It's just a thing that you did rather than discuss. But I realized that approach is obviously what he applies, or other statisticians do, to baseball, but also something that I do with pretty much everything, whether I was writing an essay for school, or I'm doing graphic design now in my spare time. If, you know, I could draw someone's entire face, or I could just draw half of it and then just flip it over. And for me, that's breaking that system. And it sounds like quite a negative approach to take, but I think it's a really interesting concept to apply to sort of everyday life.
Just like finding a shortcut, taking a shortcut, you mean?
Yeah, but not in a kind of, not because you're lazy, although I am. So, you know, I'm a really bad example.
Because it's efficient, because it's effective.
Yeah, but there's also something, it's like problem solving as well. I look at graphic design like problem solving. I need to draw X. How do I get to that route? So it looks good and it's also efficient. But it also, you know, returning it to baseball, not making it all about me and my moonlighting, it helped me understand the motivation for the way that people look at baseball stats as well. It's not just, oh, you know, I love numbers, therefore. It's like, how can I break this thing down and understand it better? And the fact that sabermetricians can also influence the way that things are measured by organizations makes it all the more satisfying. There's an actual tangible outcome. You're not just in your bedroom doing this thing. You can sort of communicate your findings with others. Sorry, that was a real monologue about me there, but I love that breaking one.
Yeah, I think I'm the same. Not necessarily with computer games. My one is to try and find the shortest possible route between A and B when I'm walking.
Yeah,
is when you start, I don't know if you do that, maybe it's just me, but if I've got a route that I do all the time, like for example, if I normally cycle to work, but if I have to get the train, then I have to walk to train station, and I want to make it as effective as efficient as possible. And I think when other people aren't doing that, I think, why aren't you doing that? Why would you go the long way around? And yeah, maybe it's just a bit of reflection on me.
No, I think it's a reflection. If you have discrete events that you repeat again and again, yeah, you are just naturally inclined to try and hone it.
Yeah.
And baseball is the a gamified version of that.
Yeah,
for money and for points.
Yeah, it's a repeat. It's a repeating of the same event over and over again. So why not make it as effective and efficient as possible?
Yeah.
Phil, what's your weird thing that you do?
I was like, wow, there's a lot of introspection going on, because my favorite anecdotes in the book,
keep it clean.
Well, my favorite anecdotes in the books had nothing to do with like me learning anything about myself. They just made me laugh, which was one where the one where his school is responsible for voting for the homecoming queen or yeah, the prom queen, and trusting that decision to like 17-year-old teenage boys, and thinking that, you know, one way of looking at it would be to look at the impact that she had on the school and the stuff that she'd done in terms of like outreach, but actually it's just 17-year-old boys voting on the fittest woman. But the other was when Russell and Tanya got married, and they looked at the large bouquet of flowers that was beside the altar, and it said beloved grandmother on it, because that bouquet hadn't been moved out from the funeral earlier in the day. So I learned nothing about myself. I just love a good laugh.
It was funny. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think you got that from the interview as well, but he's a really charismatic person. He's very warm, and he's got a really good sense of humor. And I think that comes across really well in the book. It's not dry. It could be, if you removed, I mean, even with the psychology, it could have been delivered in a really bland, clinical, sort of sterile way, but he manages to deliver it in a really fun way, a really funny way. And there were times in the book where it actually makes you laugh, and it's good. I think that's probably the reason why it is so accessible, because it allows people to have that bit of relief from the times when there is quite a lot of gory math, as Russell puts it.
Yeah, I think the book needs those moments to break up some like quite complex stuff that you have to get your head around. I mean, it's not for everyone. I noticed that some of the reviews online don't like that, but I think the majority love it.
One of the things I mentioned to Russell when we spoke was about you know, him not being able to write for a public audience anymore now that he's actually working with the New York Mets. What would you like to see him discuss, perhaps another baseball book or not? You know, if you could commission him to write about anything. He did joke about maybe writing some fiction one day. What is there something that you would like to see Russell Carlton doing in the world of book publishing?
Definitely. I mean, this is very selfish of me. My first thought was I'd love to let Russell loose on data about financial crime because of what I do for a living. Because what I tend to find is in within the kind of sphere of law enforcement, you've got sort of two extremes. I mean, it was a bit like when I joined as an analyst, the City of London Police, about sort of 10 years ago or so. It was very much like Moneyball. You had people that said, you can't tell me which door to kick down. You know, I've been doing this for years. And I was like, well, if you just break down the numbers, that guy's guilty. And there was a real sort of conflict between those two things. And now it's more of a kind of symbiotic relationship. But within the world of financial crime, it is very much data driven. We're making far more of an effort to sort of take huge data sets to try and sort of predict what's going to happen and what the most bad things are, which isn't a technical term. But where Russell is uniquely qualified is that he understands the human human element. Oh, please do keep that in. It means that he's not just focused on the figures. I think he'd be interested in applying what he's learned with the clinical psychology background as well. And that isn't something that's brought to the fore very often, which is what is the motivation for someone to scam somebody out of £50,000? And what could we learn from that moving forward? It's such a rare combination of skills that, well, at least I haven't seen in my industry.
Phil?
I want more tales from the psychologist chair. That's something I'd be fascinated in. I work in the book industry, and I've like looked into this area within the last year or so, and how memoirs from doctors and surgeons and psychotherapists And yeah, whether they're stories from the theater or stories from the psychologist's couch, seem to have replaced like the misery memoir in the UK as books, memoirs that sell in incredibly high numbers. So I'd like to know more about that. And in terms of a book about baseball, this, he mentions like towards the end of the book, because he's an is he an Indians fan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Their trip to the World Series, and he talks about the Indians Cubs series in 2016 and how Corey Kluber was pitching on 3 days rest. So I think it'd be fascinating to look at what rules tend to go out the window between the regular season and the postseason, and why. Because I think that thing is fascinating, like bringing in starters as relievers, and yeah, pitching starters on only a few days rest, and the looking at the difference between tactics and management in the postseason versus the regular season is something I think would be quite interesting.
Definitely, mine's perhaps boringly about baseball. You know, I think this field, or this area in terms of like human psychology and understanding the effect of behavior, human behavioral psychology on players and how that works within a team setting, I think that's really, really interesting and something that's gonna be a big part of the future. I mean, it's almost like we've got to a stage where we're living in a sort of post-statistical era in baseball, in a sense, and like everybody has access to so much data now, that it's just about how you analyze that data and what you can do in terms of getting this leg up is to understand perhaps how you can affect that data, perhaps rather than about using the data and applying it to affect situations and managing situations in the most effective way possible. It might be about seeing how you can affect behavior, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd like to see a bit more of that. I mean, one of the things I'm really, really interested in as a Giants fan is Bruce Bochy's last season with the Giants. And he's been a massive part of their success over the last few years, obviously in the period that he's been there, but ultimately he's almost certainly going to finish with a losing record. And there are people out there who are sort of saying that perhaps he should have gone a little bit earlier, or sort of people starting to say that the Giants might not be as bad if they had a more analytically minded manager now, who was perhaps prepared to take a few more risks and to apply a little bit more of the data or the sabermetric ideas anyway. And I wonder what's going to happen to the Giants when he leaves. And I'd be really interested to sort of try and see how much the manager has an impact on things. I know that there's analysis of it. I'm talking about even the difference between the very best and the very worst is often as little as a win or two over the course of a season. But I can't believe that there isn't some area, some facet of the relationship between the manager and the players, that kind of clubhouse effect. There must be something there that you could try and work out and quantify, or attempt to quantify anyway. I'd be really interested to see if there's more scope for research there. But that's a bit dry and baseball-y.
No, not at all. That's one of the things, the main things I took away from it. He mentions the Skinner box that proved that human behavior is observable from the outside looking in. And I think it's only a matter of time, or it's already happening. How far, much further can you go with the stats that you get from discrete events in the game itself? It's got to be the mental state or their lives outside, provided you can turn it into some kind of metrics. Or maybe I'm just being a bit limited in turning it into numbers. But for me, that the turning point is going to be that when you can prove, and this sits outside of MLB as well, I often think about football in terms of the way it treats mental health or doesn't treat it, is that until you have the figures that can demonstrate that a positive surrounding players with the things that they need to give them a good life and make sure their mental health isn't suffering, until you can prove that isn't positive in terms of your performances on the pitch and therefore you make more money, people aren't going to be interested in doing it. And one of the reasons I like what Russell is doing so much is he is contributing to that. And it's tragic that it's going to be underpinned by it being profitable. But then again, we do live in a capitalist society, so that is the bottom line. Mm. And if the overall outcome is that people, their mental health is improved. I mean, he references one of my favorite chapters is the one where he just challenges the idiot things that fans say about, oh, if I'd been in charge, I would have done, you know, all that nonsense. Mm. And the example he uses is like a kid comes in from the Dominican Republic, doesn't know anyone, and he isn't getting the support he needs, and his performance drops off, and you as a manager have to step in and try and sort of, you know, snap him out of this funk that he's in. And it's the kind of thing that people for some reason just don't appreciate as being vital. And I feel like Russell and others must be leading the charge to address that, prove that it's got value, and therefore other teams will start to do it as well, hopefully.
Definitely. Phil, I mean, what do you think that this is something that's going to be a big part of the future? I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whether big is the word I'd use, because as you see throughout the book, I think baseball is so advanced in terms of its like statistical analysis of the impact that certain things can have on runs and wins that we're now talking about the real minutiae. And there's an example of the book where it talks about throwing to first to check in on a runner. And that if a pitcher does that, it makes the runner 6% less likely to steal, which counts as 0.04 of a run expected improvement value to your defense. So, big revolutions that are going to happen in baseball that's going to miraculously make one team, add an extra 40 wins to their win column.
That's what I reckon, though, because all the things that he discussed about, everyone's obviously conversant with the concept of marginal gains, but these are tiny, 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 tiny little things.
Yeah.
And obviously if you add them all together, everything like that, you know, you're going to have an impact, but surely it's the human element.
It's the biggest one. Yeah,
this is surely the thing that's going to be the driver of this will be the next shift.
Yeah, I'd hope so. And I think that reading the book, it's reassuring to think that baseball is, and maybe American sports in general, are ahead of UK sports in that kind of field. Like Dr. Steve Peters has only, you know, been a name that's been commonly used since like London 2012, maybe. But like sports psychologists in general, it's only in the last decade or so, I think, that people are talking about it's like as them having a major impact on the performance of sports teams in the UK. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the human element will lead to like a massive quantifiable shift 2.0.
I mean,
it's interesting
thinking about probably wrapping up, but we did have a question on Twitter, put some questions out on the Twitter handle at RTGpod, and we did have one come back. Is baseball the sport that has the most to learn and gain from the world of psychology? What do we think about that? I mean, you've already compared baseball and US sports there with football, a soccer. What do you reckon? Henry?
Yeah, I mean, I'm at risk of repeating myself, mainly because I am. But yeah, that was my first thought. I initially thought baseball does have the most to gain, but then I have just read The Shift, so I'm probably, you know, recency bias. But I did think it wasn't so long ago with football that people were mocking Stan Collymore for suffering from depression because you're a millionaire, so, you know, get your stuff together. Mm. And then also you see footballers like Michael Johnson that used to play for Man City is now kind of regular fodder for, you know, you won't believe these 10 players that have let themselves go. And it's just, you're mocking a guy who I believe had a relatively sort of hard time and then dropped out of the game. And as, yes, we are sort of taking baby steps towards treating mental health. Just because you're a millionaire playboy footballer, you know, it still needs to be taken seriously. So I'd love to see people like Russell leading the charge by unfortunately having to highlight the fact it's got value in terms of results and money, and that's what it's going to take, I think, because otherwise football's treatment of mental health tends to be reactive when something terrible happens.
Yeah
So without the stats to underpin it, I don't think you're going to see meaningful change anytime soon.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but I think you're probably right. All right, well, we should probably finish there because I'm very conscious of time sort of creeping away.
Sorry to end it on a downer there, because this has been great. So thank you, guys.
Once the theme tune starts, it'll be happy.
I think we can sum up. I think we can sum up and just say it's a really, really good book. It's not just a good book. It's a really good and welcome addition to the genre, because, like I said, without wanting to name names or anything, I think just generally across the genre, it can be very, very dry. It can be very, very statistically heavy. And this is neither of those things. It's accessible. It's informative. And like I said, it's had an impact on the way that I watch baseball. And like you said, Henry, it's had an impact on the way you think about life generally. I mean, that's a solid recommendation for.
Oh, absolutely. I would recommend everybody read this book, whether you follow baseball or not, especially if you do follow, but you're into baseball, and especially if you've just finished reading Moneyball, because I just think this adds layers to that experience. And Moneyball is a great book, and you can get through it in a couple of days because it's so compelling. But at the end of the day, it does oversimplify things. And this, you know, we live in a time when everything's highly polarized. And this is a brilliant reminder that real life is incredibly complicated, and the truth very often just lies in the middle, or you can't answer a question at all because it's so complicated. And there isn't a convenient answer to certain questions. And this book, for being so honest about that, it was a real tonic, for want of a better term.
Yeah, a really good, solid summing up there, Phil. Do you want to add?
I can't follow that.
No, I was just about to say.
Thank you.
I'm not even going to try to. All right. Well, thanks very much, Henry. Where can we hear more of your stuff?
Yeah, well, if you're a glutton for punishment, come on over to Absolute Bunts. That's the podcast that I do with my good friend John McKenzie, and you can follow us at Absolute Bunts on Twitter. If you love images of rays bursting out of the water in baseball-themed memes.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on. It was really good of you to give up your time and for bearing with us. I had a really good time. It's not a downer. It's been very thoughtful. I think it's really encouraged me to reflect. Perhaps, I mean, you obviously prepare for a podcast and you think a lot about the book. And I'd even spoken to Russ about the book, but it wasn't until having this round table now, this little discussion here, that some stuff's really come into the forefront of my mind. Like, I was never anticipating disclosing the fact that I've got a weird thing where I have to walk here.
I bring this kind of stuff out of people.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting that to surface this evening. So well done. That's a self-disclosure of my own there. I think Russell will be very pleased with me. And thanks, Phil, very much again for coming on, obviously. All right.
Cheers, guys. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye-bye.